This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. And we're talking this segment about the many events that are happening in Santa Fe this week and in the coming weeks having to do with William Shakespeare. And joining us here at the table in the baking company is Kristen Bundesen, Vice President of the International Shakespeare Center here in Santa Fe. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we have Ariana Karp, who's founding member of Duc Dame Ensemble and Associate Director of the International Shakespeare Center. Rodney Cotier, who is head of drama at the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art. Joanna Reed, who is principal there. Judith Phillips, who is head of voice there. Welcome, everybody, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Now, Kristen, first of all, a lot of what's going on here is because of the work of the International Shakespeare Center.
Yes, it is. All the activities are in support of the first folio exhibition at the Museum of Art. But the two of the founding members of International Shakespeare Center brought the project to the attention of the museum and helped gather up all of the letters of support and community programming, and then it sort of steamrolled and we formalized. And so International Shakespeare Center is responsible for just under half of all the 30 activities happening in the shortest month of the year, February, in support of the first folio and the 400th anniversary of the death of William Shakespeare, which is a worldwide celebration. We don't normally celebrate deaths, we celebrate birthdays, but Shakespeareans will take any opportunity to celebrate this canon
of
work.
Some years ago it was the birth, then his 20th birthday.
So, and one of the amazing things is that the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art were willing to send three of their top teaching artists to Santa Fe to conduct workshops. And so Joanna Reed, who is head of the school out of the oldest theater conservatory in England, is here teaching. Rodney is teaching and Judith is teaching, and we're getting the benefit of their talents for this week. And Ariana is directing an original show called Dames of Thrones.
So, Ariana Karp, let's talk about Dames of Thrones. First of all, how did you come to Shakespeare? You have worked with some of these esteemed folks at the table from Lambda, which we'll talk about in a moment, the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art, which is an amazing institution in itself. But how did you come to found the Duc Dame Ensemble?
Well, it's all sort of a wonderfully happy circumstance kind of story. I worked with Carol Farkas, who is the president of the ISC, when I was growing up in Madison, Wisconsin. We were all involved, her family and my family were involved with a company called the Young Shakespeare Players that does uncut Shakespeare for kids age 6 to 18. And I joined when I was 13, and I was completely addicted. I did 36 productions in 6 years with them. And then sort of things took a turn. I went off to university. I came back. Carol and I co-directed a production together, which was really fun. And then they moved to Santa Fe. I went off to drama school, and I met all of these wonderful people at Lambda. And we really, really gelled as a class, all 19 of us, and we sort of thought, well, why not continue to produce work together? And after we graduated, we formed the Duc Dame Ensemble. And as we were putting up our first production, which was sort of a revival of something we had done at Lambda in New York, in the New York Fringe Festival, I got a call from Carol saying, hey, I've just gotten in touch with Lambda. We're going to bring them out for this first folio festival. Would you like to come out with a few of the members of your theater company and sort of work in a supporting capacity in their workshops? And I brought that to the group, and 17 of the 19 people were like, I'm there. Buy me a ticket. I'm there. And I said, well, we got a few more than two or three. And so then it was proposed that we put a show on and bring it out here in addition to doing work in the Lambda workshops.
So tell us about the Dames angle.
So the Dames of Thrones, is it, there's sort of two simple facts that were the genesis of the production. One is that there's 19 founding members of Duc d'Aumé Ensemble, and 12 of them are women. But if you look at the cast breakdowns for most of most classical theater plays, there's about three times as many men as women. So that's always something when you have a very female-heavy cast that you need to address. Are you going to do cross-gender casting where the women play men? Are you going to have people double up on roles? It's just, it's always something to be addressed.
Now, cross-gender casting is kind of a thing now?
Yes, yeah. It's becoming quite a trend. The Donmar Warehouse in London has sort of, is doing this trilogy of three Shakespeare plays that are all female casts, including very prominent Lambda alumni, Harriet Walter, in the leading role. They did Julius Caesar, I believe she played Brutus, and they just completed Henry IV, which was a sort of compilation of Henry IV parts 1 and 2, and she played Henry IV. And then they haven't announced their third collaboration, but it's quite a trend right now.
What is up with that? Like, what's behind that? I mean, is it about shifting gender roles and the focus on sort of transgender people in society?
I actually think it's even more basic than that. I think whenever you have good writing, and I think it would be very difficult to find better writing than Shakespeare. There is a gender component to Shakespeare's work, but it's always about the humanity underneath. It's always the driving force. I mean, I think he was a humanist. He writes about people and about their ideas. And as an actor, that's the only in that you really need, is a fantastic script.
But it seems like so much of it is specifically exactly about gender, because there's men playing women playing men and all that kind of stuff.
Well, and I think traditionally, there, because Shakespeare was writing for an all-male cast, you know, and these young boys would be playing the women, there's a lot of gender bending that's already sort of inherent to the plots of his stories, particularly the comedies.
Why were there only men actors at that time?
That was kind of the rule of the day, really.
Yeah.
It would have been considered very unseemly for a woman to be on stage. They weren't invited in. So they had the boys' companies who did their own particular group of plays. But as Ariana said, the women were played by young boys until their voice broke. Yeah.
And were there women in the audience?
Yeah, there'd be women in the audience, absolutely.
Interesting.
But interestingly enough, in continental Europe at the same time, there were women on the stage, which is something we looked at in our training, was going through visiting the Spanish Golden Age, for example. The women's roles were written for female actresses. So it's an interesting sort of cultural difference.
And you get some roles like Cleopatra, you know, iconic role for a woman. And there are some theorists who think that actually that was played by a female actress.
So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So tell us more about Dame of Thrones.
Yeah, so Dames of Thrones is this...
Dames of Thrones,
yeah.
Sorry.
There's many dames.
This is a very Game of Thrones town.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that was actually part of the reason that the title seems so fitting. Also because I believe that George R.R. Martin took a lot of his plot points from Shakespeare's history plays and the Wars of the Roses. And so these scenes are all from Shakespeare's history plays, which haven't really enjoyed as rich a performance history in this country as, say, his tragedies and comedies. I think everyone's seen at least 10 productions of A Midsummer Night's Dream by the time they're 15. Probably everybody, and has been in at least two. I think it's more of a rare thing to say, oh, yes, I saw a very good production of Richard II in, you know, where I'm from, Madison, Wisconsin.
Right.
Because they're just not done as often, which I think is a real shame, because they have incredibly dynamic characters. They have, especially in an election year, I think they're amazing if you're looking at political upheavals and changing
intrigue.
Alliances.
Yeah.
Intrigue, gossip. I mean, it's got the whole... It's got everything, really. But I was very interested in the women in these plays, because these are plays that are very much dominated by male political figures, and they're all named after the man who was on the throne at the time. But I wanted to look at what the women in these plays go through, because it's a pretty sad lot in life, and that's sort of what the show goes through, is watching. It's almost like you're watching one woman go through all these different stages of life: betrothal, marriage, becoming a mother, usually some sort of very big betrayal, And then becoming a widow, and then the cycle sort of starts over again, marriage and motherhood. And so it's a very uplifting show. No, I'm lying, it's not. But it is I think it's an interesting exploration. It has some just absolutely dynamite scenes for actresses. One of the characters, Queen Margaret, she's I think the largest character study in all of Shakespeare, because she appears in four of Shakespeare's plays.
Is that right?
From in all three parts of Henry VI, and then into Richard III, which is probably her most famous appearance in this country in terms of her theatrical appearance. But I chose a few scenes in there because it's just dynamite. I mean, you go from her being this young woman to sort of falling in love. She gets married. She has an affair with this nice-looking duke. she loses him. She carries his head around in a basket.
As you do.
Like you do when your lover's been killed. She becomes a mother. She, you know, she's out on the battlefield in part three. She literally kills one of her greatest enemies. And then, you know, at the height of this amazing sort of power that she's had, she watches her son stabbed in front of her eyes. And then we sort of see her haunting the courtroom of Richard III and sort of cursing everyone. So she's a fascinating character, and I think one of the best female characters in all of Shakespeare. And it's just a shame to me that she isn't sort of more well known in this country. And that's sort of what we wanted to do. And it's bringing sort of unjustly neglected works of such potency, I think, is a very important thing for any classical theater company to do.
And so in this performance, which, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, is tonight.
Yeah.
How many people are in it?
So there's 13 actors in the cast. I have 8 women and 5 men, and the women each have sort of their big scene, and then I sort of have I've given the boys quite a task in that they sort of are in every scene. I believe one of my male actors is in 9 of the 11 scenes, and he sort of, now I have an American accent, now I have a Northern accent, now I'm British, you know. But there, it's really fun to explore these scenes. And also, I really wanted it to feel like a unified production. So a lot of our aesthetic development as a company has come from the fact that we trained at Lambda together. And the emphasis on clear and exciting storytelling is very much a part of our company. And so there's a couple movement sequences as well that sort of link the scenes together and sort of give you the end of whatever that story of the woman that you've just seen, whether that's, you know, her husband being killed on the battle, whether it's her being killed by her husband in Lady Anne's case, or, you know, debatable. Yeah, we use so much of our training from Lambda as part of the devising of our creative process as well.
So that is tonight, Dames of Thrones at 7:30 at the Adobe Rose Theater here in Santa Fe. Ariana Karp, now let's talk a little bit more about Lambda. Let's turn now to Joanna Reed, who's principal of Lambda, the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art. This is an institution which probably, if you're British, we would all be kneeling before you. And Americans haven't probably
British,
heard of it.
They'd be ignoring me.
But I mean, it's like the equivalent
so
of
we
Juilliard.
Are, yeah, it's the equivalent of Juilliard or Yale Rep, perhaps. We're the oldest drama school in the United Kingdom. We're over 153 years old. And we have been training actors and directors and stage managers in theatre, film and screen for, say, 153 years. Your listeners would know some of our alumni. So Benedict Cumberbatch is the name on everybody's lips. He trained at
you
Lambda.
You mean Sherlock Holmes.
I mean Sherlock Holmes, yeah, trained at Lambda. Ruth Wilson, David Oyelowo, Chiwetel Ejiofor, Harriet Walter. So, and American actors, John Lithgow, trained with Lambda. He came over and did a Fulbright scholarship with us in the 50s and 60s. Donald Sutherland is one of ours as well. Dana Ivey.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So this is something I've always wondered. I mean, there are many dancers who say that you have to have classical ballet training no matter mm-hmm. what kind of training you do. Is there an analogy, like if you're an actor, you have to do Shakespeare?
For me, yes. I mean, for me, Shakespeare and the teaching the classical canon, it's at the root of what Lambda does. There are many things that are distinct about us as a drama school. We put a lot of focus on the ensemble, on people working together, on a company of actors coming together to tell a story and to communicate that story effectively to the audience. And that's what Shakespeare does.
Yeah.
You know, you have a group of 16 people, acting troupe, coming together, being able to transform, play different characters to tell that story.
So you're not emphasizing the star aspect so
not
much?
Not at all, no. We emphasize the training. What are you offering? What are you bringing to the table? How can I help you? How can we together tell this story? Because, I mean, the theatre and TV, they are collaborative art forms. They don't work in isolation. You know, me in my bedroom being brilliant in my play is no good to anybody. You can't see me, and who am I talking to?
Right.
But me working with you, telling a story so people can hear and listen to it and engage with it, and it can affect and move and change them, that's where theatre can be exciting and powerful and can be enhancing and transforming.
It's interesting that you just said theater and TV as opposed to theater and film, because there's so much good TV.
There's so much brilliant TV around at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we're living through a golden age. The writing is so fantastic.
Yeah.
The acting. I mean, I have to say, when I come over to the States and we bring our students to LA to showcase them, I do get it in the neck from casting directors, because it's, what are all your British actors doing over here, taking our roles and taking our jobs? But
well, they are. How about the affair with Ruth Wilson and Dominic West playing two Americans?
Absolutely. Ruth Wilson is one of ours, and she's tremendous. He's tremendous. I mean, they are brilliant American actors, some of whom also trained at Lambda. So that's, but it's just a really exciting and fruitful time, I think, in the industry.
So you, last night, and I'm sorry we couldn't get you on the air yesterday, but you were on an airplane until the very last minute, but you were leading a workshop on creating characters from the text of Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
Now, are you talking about Romeo and Juliet themselves or other characters?
Talking about Romeo and Juliet in Romeo and Juliet. So I was looking at the balcony scene because it's an iconic scene. Everybody thinks they know that scene inside out, and I think we know Romeo and Juliet as characters in the story very well. And I was hoping to look at the assumptions we make about character. And actually, an actor's job is to go back and investigate, to mine the text. What are you saying? Why are you saying it? And from that comes the story, and from that comes the character.
Now, give us an example, like the balcony scene. Everybody thinks they know it. What do we think we know that we don't?
I'm making an assumption here, but my assumption is that you think they meet on the, you know, they meet, they fall in love. The balcony scene is a scene about wooing. At the end of it, they're both in love with each other. They go away, and I think you think Romeo probably drives the scene. He comes to pursue Juliet. I'm not sure it's actually like that when you pull the scene apart and have a good look at it.
And what is it like?
I think she drives the scene. I think he doesn't know what he's doing when he hops over that wall. And he's gone there with one view in mind, and actually he's wrong-footed all the way through the scene. And it's also a scene in which you really show how the language, how the construction of the scene gives you the sexual tension in the scene. Because obviously she's at her window, he's down there in the garden. And they don't get to touch, they don't get to kiss in that scene, and yet it's an incredibly sensual scene. It gets very sexy towards the end of it. But it starts with potential chaos and sort of almost comedy value. He's literally climbed over a wall, landed in a bush to hide away from his mates in order to try and have another glimpse of her before he goes home for the evening.
Right.
So it's almost a clash of expectations.
And when you frame it that way in contemporary language, it becomes more accessible.
It's much more exciting as well, yeah.
And
I think he's pretty rubbish at wooing as well when he starts off. He's got this idea about what language is and what poetry is and how he's going to woo her, and she just cuts all through that, absolutely. And his language isn't very good at the beginning of the scene. It gets better. You see their language. I mean, that's what's brilliant about Shakespeare. There's no subtext. It's all within the language and the imagery. So their language changes as their relationship changes. The Romeo who you meet at the beginning of the play obviously is not going to be the Romeo at the end, because he's gone through transformations, because he's been in situations that have moved and changed him. And Shakespeare reflects that in the language and the imagery they use. There's a wonderful moment where they start to swap imagery. And they're talking about birds and doves and sort of falcons, and he borrows her language. Before that, his poetry and his image, it's all about stars and moon, and it's all a bit kind of standard, basic poetry. He's kind of like the roses are red, violets are blue, sort
right,
of.
Right, right.
And he grows up, and by the end, by the time you get them into the tomb, it's much more robust language, it's much more moving.
And she's kind of driven that.
She's driven that, yeah.
Very, very interesting. We're talking to Joanna Reed from the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art. Let's turn now to Judith Phillips, who is the head of voice there. What does it mean to be head of voice?
Well, my job is focused on speaking voice, because we also have a singing department. And I would say the drive of my particular work as head of voice is to link, if you like, the technical aspects of what makes your voice work, so your breathing muscles, your articulation muscles, the things that you need to be able to communicate sound across space, or indeed down a microphone if you're doing film and television, to link that into what Joanna's eloquently described as the language. How do you use the language? And personally, that's the area I'm very interested in. How do I cross over the technique into the language?
There are so many different ways of interpreting Shakespeare, not only in the way people act, but in the way they speak. And I've heard Shakespeare delivered in a very kind of, I don't know, it's hard to even say what's traditional because you don't know how it was delivered in
Absolutely.
Shakespeare's own time, but in a very kind of dramatic manner. And then you hear people speaking as if they were talking to you on the street. And those are different ways of doing it, and they mean different things. Is that part of the voice?
Absolutely it is. I mean, I think to a large degree, people's response to the way that Shakespeare is done is connected with the taste of the time. So when we hear recordings of people doing Shakespeare in the early 20th century to the mid-20th century, it can sound slightly ridiculous to us now because it's very, you know, very delivered.
Right. I
would say now that what I talk to my students about is that we want to hear you within the text. So it's the relationship between the way that you sound and what the text is offering. It doesn't become conversational because it's not. It's heightened, massive language.
Yeah.
So you have to find how you respond as a speaking, breathing, living person to something where the stakes are not at even at 10 but at 11 in Spinal Tap terms, if you've seen that. And in order to do that, you can't just stand there and do it. You do have to learn how to be able to wrap your mouth around the words, and most importantly for me, how to make that language yours so that young people in particular feel that it can belong to them.
Right.
And while Ariana very sweetly said all of us have seen 12 versions of Midsummer Night's Dream, most people that I teach at Lambda in the first year have not.
Right.
They do not have that privilege.
Right.
They may not have read any Shakespeare at all. They may not know anything about it. So it's part of my job to excite them about it and to get them to a point where they believe that language belongs to them. And I feel very deeply about that, almost to the point where I'm getting a bit tearful. But that's possibly jet lag.
I would imagine that part of that is learning the vocabulary so that you know the words as if they were contemporary English.
Completely, so that you're not in a state where you're translating as you're speaking.
Right.
And I'd encourage students not to feel they've got to paraphrase every word of Shakespeare in order to understand it, but that occasionally you meet bits like teasing out the knots in your hair, where it may be tricky and you need to tease those bits apart. But I think the idea of translating Shakespeare disturbs me hugely. You don't need to translate Shakespeare, it's in English. It's just working out the tricky bits. And there's some fantastic editions that we've got. I'm very fond of Jonathan Bate's RSC edition because he has at the bottom of the page, he gives you the words that are difficult. So it makes it open to just about anybody who wants to tackle it.
Do you find yourself and your colleagues speaking Elizabethan English to each other?
Perpetually.
Verily, oft. Many a time and oft we do that.
We greet each other in the morning only in the iambic pentameter at Lambda, yes.
I mean, I would if I were in your shoes. Because if it's becoming part of you, you would use it creatively in your everyday life.
Yes, you do. And I think undoubtedly it widens. You know, this is one of the reasons why we keep working with it, even though it's becoming, it is challenging.
But it's rich, isn't it?
It's so rich. And kids now, and I mean, I'm not a kid, but I do it as well. You know, we've become very visual. We're tweeting and on our phones and speaking. When I was growing up, we used to be on the landline for an hour and a half to our friends, annoying the parents, whereas now my kids are clicking up in their rooms, you know.
Which is funny. It's the loss of the human voice.
Yeah, of speaking and engaging and loving language for the sake of it. And I think once you start engaging with Shakespeare and you start finding these extraordinary words, that I think that does excite young people hugely when they discover how much language can offer them. It's a good starting point. It's a tricky starting point, but I still think it's the best, you know.
And we do use it as code in the school as well. If there's a tricky moment, one of us will check in a quote occasionally. Yeah, we just know what the other one's saying.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Judith, tomorrow afternoon, you're going to be leading a workshop on sonnets at the Shakespeare Sonnets at the History Museum here in Santa Fe. What will you be doing? I mean, teaching people to read them aloud?
What I'm planning to do is basically show the kind of work that I've developed that I do in class. So I'll have some of the Duc d'Armée actors with me, and I'm going to try and organise it that maybe a few people join in if they feel they want to from the floor as well. And I'll go through a number of exercises that I do to help people connect the language of the sonnets into their bodies and their voice and enjoy the language.
Would you be willing to recite a sonnet?
Yes. Yes, of course. Do you want me to do it now?
Yes.
Okay, so everybody else, look away and gaze into the middle distance, please. How like a winter hath my absence been from thee, the pleasure of the fleeting year. What freezings have I felt, what dark days seen, what old December's bareness everywhere. And yet this time removed was summer's time, the teeming autumn big with rich increase, bearing the wanton burthen of the prime like widowed wounds after their lord's decease. Yet this abundant issue seemed to me but hope of orphans and unfathered fruit, for summer and his pleasures wait on thee, and thou away the very birds are mute, or if they sing, 'tis with so dull a cheer that leaves look pale, dreading the winters near.
Judith Philip, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
So now, Rodney Cotier, you are the head of drama at Lambda. What does that mean?
That means I'm responsible for coordinating all the elements of our training, vocal training and physical training and acting, and with Joanna coming up with a program of work for our professional actors.
Now, is your own background being a Shakespearean actor, stage actor?
I've been connected with Lambda now since the late 70s. I trained there as an actor, and I haven't left yet.
Oh, my goodness.
We wouldn't let him leave, basically. We held on to him.
So, yes, having trained as an actor, I've then become a director, and my passion, even before Lambda, was Shakespeare in particular, and Shakespeare's contemporaries, the Jacobean playwrights, going through to the Restoration period. So really, my theatre ends at 1714. apart from being at Lambda, I was very, very lucky, in as much as I was asked to join Mark Rylance at Shakespeare's Globe as his Master of Fight, because I'm also a fight director. And so
nice.
I got to work with him on the Globe stage for about 8 years and work with him on Hamlet, amongst others.
I sometimes wonder if Shakespeare for Shakespeareans is kind of like the American Constitution for people following that. There are originalists and there are interpreters who take it in different directions.
Yeah.
And, I mean, how much do we know about how Shakespeare was really performed in Shakespeare's time?
We don't. We know very little about Shakespeare. That is the truth. I mean, where we're very lucky is that, I think it's one of the wonders of the world. I know we've got the Great Pyramid, but if it wasn't for two actors, we would have lost 17 of Shakespeare's plays, including the Scottish play and The Tempest. These two actors had the presence of mind to gather together as many of his plays as they could and had them published in the First Folio, which you now have in town.
Right.
And I do believe that if you look at the folio, and indeed the quartos, which predate that, that is where you will find the evidence as to how Shakespeare worked.
What is the nature of that evidence?
It's rather as Judith was talking about. If you actually speak the words, you suddenly discover the rhythms. And when you discover the rhythms and the change of rhythms, the character comes through and the play comes alive. And it's, I mean, Shakespeare has given it to you. I mean, that is the extraordinary genius of the man, by these rhythms and counter-rhythms. I mean, his choice of words, it's so rich, and he's guiding you. And that is so exciting.
It's all in the text. Absolutely all in the text. Yeah. As a director teaching an actor, when you're working on Shakespeare, you always go back to the text. What are you saying? Why are you saying it? Listen to what you're saying. How's it sitting in your body? What does it sound like? How does that sound affect the audience? All the clues, all the rules are in there. When you come on, when you go off, it's all there.
And so because it is so rich in the text and because all the clues are there, how does that affect the way you might put together a production? I mean, there are people, and I think Ariana was talking about this in a video that she made, that there's one way of performing which has a very spare set, not a lot of scenery, minimal props, and so on. Or you can have these incredibly elaborate, rich sets. Do you...
Well, I mean, I think having... I mean, I've directed one play over 10 times now. It's never going to come out the same.
Which one?
Is King Lear.
Okay.
But it's never going to come out the same because you're working with different actors and you're going to go on a journey with them and things are going to happen. Rather like you can go and see a great painting and every time you go back to it, you discover something new. Every time you go back to a great text, something new happens, and that's exciting. So long as you don't go in there with a preconceived idea, this is how it's going to be, but actually go on the journey with your group of actors, which is your ensemble.
So that ensemble might drive whether you decide to, for example, have modern costumes?
Absolutely. I mean, I think if you try to ram a concept at the very beginning of a rehearsal period, you're forcing something rather than allowing it to happen. Mm. And that is what's so exciting. I mean, I remember, I know Joanna's talked about Romeo and Juliet, and it wasn't one of my favourites until I directed it.
Yeah.
And then I discovered, oh my God, what an idiot I've been all my life. It's the most extraordinary play. Because I was open with a group of actors to explore what's going to happen. I mean, the ensemble goes back to the Greeks.
Yeah.
A group of actors create great work. Shakespeare, a group of actors, 14 actors, the Globe might argue for 15, working together, came up with a very exciting piece of work. And they changed it. Mm. If you look at the quartos to the folios, you can see where, oh, we did that and we've made some changes because we've revised it.
Yeah.
And that's exciting.
Changes based on time as well. If things got popular or if a bit went down well, it would come back in again. Or,
yes.
You know, I'll write a bit of this in now because that's what the crowd are looking for. There was, you know, he was very responsive to the audience and to the particular actors he had at that time.
Absolutely. I mean, he created a character of Falstaff and then brought him back for Shakespeare's only sitcom, Merry Miser Windsor.
Yes,
right.
A hit.
Yeah, because they all loved Falstaff. Let's see him again. Yeah.
Now, you are leading a masterclass on the first folio at the Folk Art Museum this coming Friday evening.
Yep.
What's that about?
Okay, what I'm going to do is, it's a 3-hour practical workshop. I will talk for about an hour, and I'll talk a bit about the folio, and then I'm going to talk about the Globe, because having worked there, I've found by working there, it has unlocked a lot of staging problems that I hadn't really considered and thought, ah, of course, that's how the scene works. And also, having worked the Globe, there were certain times when you realised that perhaps the design of the Globe has its pitfalls, and I will talk a bit about that. And then for the last 2 hours, we're going to get up and we're going to do an open rehearsal of the opening scene of Lear. And I'm going to use the folio. Going back to something that Mark Rylance said, when we had a symposium at the National Theatre many years ago, Hamlet says, we'll hear a play tomorrow night, not we'll see a play tomorrow night. And if you think about that, you wouldn't go to a Greek play and go, oh, I wonder what the set's going to look like. Oh, no, it's that round again. Any more than you'd go to the Globe Theatre wondering what the set was going to look like. It was there. It was two doors, a balcony and a reveal. Mm. And so the emphasis, therefore, goes on storytelling. What's on the page? The clues are all there, and then we'll put it together and discover in the process, because I'm hoping most of the people coming are going to bring their own favourite complete works of Shakespeare, see what's happened in the last 400 years.
Well, I want to thank you all so much for being here. You can find out much more information at internationalshakespeare.center. Rodney Cotier, Judith Phillips, Joanna Reed, Kristen Bundesen, Ariana Karp, and don't forget Dames of Thrones tonight at 7:30 at the Adobe Rose Theater. Thank you all so much for being with us on
the
Radio
you.
Cafe.
Thank it's been a pleasure. Thank you
thank
so much.
You.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.